Lawrence Willey, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 27th of October 2012.
Lawrence Edward Willey, born North Shields, Northumberland, 22 November 1943.
So you're now 60?
68, be 69 in a couple of weeks.
And you have a younger brother called Ian?
No, I've got an elder brother called Ian.
Oh, Ian was ahead of you?
Yes. Not in Fitz terms.
No, you joined Fitz first, didn't you?
Yeah. I'd gone to university, did geology. By chance, ended up in the Antarctic. Ian was the explorer by attitude, but he'd become an electrical engineer. And I'd done my year, and he decided that he better come south himself. So... And I didn't know about it. First thing I knew about it was when the lists of who was going to be on what base. And Adelaide came out first, Binet, and it said Willey in Adelaide. So I sent an urgent message to London saying, there's no way I'm going to go to Adelaide. I can't do my sledging from Adelaide. And the message came back, Willey's brother.
And that's how you found out?
Yeah.
How did he feel about it?
Oh, quite pleased.
You didn't think he was being cheeky?
No. I'm glad he wasn't on my base, because I was always the kid. You know, he always pulled me out of the scrapes.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it on the... going up towards Langdale, that he was in the Scouts and I was in the Cubs. And they went off to Patterdale and they took me along as his brother. Then they dragged me up Helvellyn, I was only about 10, so literally dragged me.
You went to the Antarctic as a geologist in 66 and you were detailed to go to Stonington Base. Was that by choice or were you just...
No, that you're sent. Presumably somebody's told you that we went under sealed orders.
No, go on.
Oh. We knew where we were going, but Fuchs and AD insisted that the captain of the boat you're on would hand you your instructions outside the territorial waters.
What was the thinking behind that?
Ex-Navy tradition, top secret, blah, blah, blah.
It wasn't because you couldn't argue at that point.
Well, there was Graham Smith and I went down to Stonington that year and we were given geologized south of 71 South. So it was fairly detailed instructions. And he was an Aberdeen man and I'd done paleontology as my sort of principal geology studies. So he took the mainland and I took Alexander Island, and so there was no argument about it. And we were both very happy.
So you're working out of Stonington, but your study area was Alexander Island?
Yeah.
And that would require crossing by sea ice?
Three choices. You could have gone onto the peninsula, down the peninsula, down one of the glaciers to Alexander Island. You could have waited for the aircraft, but as we'd wiped off the aircraft pretty well, that as I went in, and there was a new aircraft coming the following year, but it was going to be late in the season. Or you could go across the sea ice. So I opted to the sea ice.
So does that mean you were camped on Alexander Island for most of the geology season?
Most of the working season until the boat came back. And then, unfortunately, that year, the GAs, which Graham and I both had, were going home. And as the belt was already happening on Alexander Island, in the Sound, I opted to go and GA for Graham on the peninsula, and it was work, I didn't mind. Graham's good company, so we enjoyed ourselves.
You travelled everywhere with dog teams, I guess?
Yep. I sledged down with, borrowed at one of the surveyors' dog teams, because the aircraft was going to be limited in its capabilities. Four of us sledged in with a team each. And I was given a team for the trip, which is a bit hair-raising, but interesting. And then I handed it over to a surveyor when I got to the bluff. And for the rest of the season, there was George McLeod and I with one team, the Terrors, which was quite adequate for the work we were doing.
And what were you finding?
Basically, it's sedimentary fossils. We were lucky, and there was that time a lot of the work on continental drift was still fresh, and I was the sort of the junior of the three, Taylor, Thompson and Willie, who put together the fossil links to South America, India, Australia and so forth. So we were very lucky at the timing we were there.
Was that part of the instruction? Was the general principle to try and back up Ade's theory that...
No, we were just sent down to find out what was there. We knew a bit of what Ade and before that, BGLE.
Hmm.
They brought out a couple of small specimens of belemnites and things. And again, Tal had taken the minutiae, Tal Taylor. He was a very good geologist, but he was interested in odd things like what crawled on the back of something rather than the something itself. Mike Thompson was the ammonite man, and I was left initially with belemnites and other mollusks, which suited me quite well.
But by the mid-60s, when you were doing your geology, the concept of continental drift was that relatively well established by then, or was it still up in the air?
No, the concept was well established, but the evidence...
Documentary evidence.
...wasn't there. The fossil evidence wasn't there, and that's what we were able to put together. And Antarctica proved to be a key for linking the other continents together. So we were very fortunate at that time that...
The right geologists in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Was it exciting? Making those kind of significant strides.
Working with those two guys, I was so lucky. You know, Tal had been back. Well, he went down 61, I think. And Mike Thompson was already home when I went down. So they were well into the ideas before I got back. And then I just got picked up and carried along with the tidal flow. So I was, the junior. But very, I got my name on the paper.
Tell me about that first, because I think there were two journeys down to Fossil Bluff, wasn't there? One that was relatively trouble-free, so let's talk about that one first.
Relatively trouble-free, but I say the sledging diary I've got, our first night away from Stonington, which was Red Rock Ridge, just round the corner, we had a Duff Primus. And we didn't know we didn't realise at the time, but George McLeod went out early the following morning to go to the toilet, and he collapsed, and we had carbon monoxide poisoning.
Oh, I see, that
day. And, we were, just reading what I've written here, we were very lucky. For the next whole of the next day, we were recovering. Fortunately, we had a spare Primus with us, so the rest of the trip was okay. But surging on sea ice is not surging on a flat carpet. Took us a month, and we had some pretty bad weather. We didn't have the hair-raising experiences of the following year, but we each had turnovers and corner this. George and Ali injured their shoulders, and I strained a leg, and I said, one of my comments is here, Antarctica, where are the fit guys? Where are the invalids? And we ended up shooting one dog. One of George's dogs collapsed and couldn't take him on, so we shot him, or George shot him, which was like shooting one of your children. Mm. George loved these dogs. The purpose of our trip was because of this new aircraft coming down, we'd been asked to sit at the puffballs just in case there was a problem with the aircraft. So we laid out an airstrip for him, but he never used it because the timing and so forth. But that's why we went out early, and just to sit there and be his backup in case there was, because there was no one at the bluff at that stage.
Mm.
If he'd had to land, as it proved the following year with the Ian's aircraft, the bluff weather and Adelaide, not Stonington weather, can be completely different, and you can get lost quite quickly. So we were there just to give him a backup. And then we got down.
You followed him then down to Fossil Bluff?
He'd got into Fossil Bluff. He'd flown, he did his first trip in Fossil Bluff, put people in, and we just motored on. Just for a surgeon, it was an interesting journey.
Did that first season of geology work go fairly smoothly?
In terms of geology, not particularly. I think I got about 20 days actually geologising out of a whole season. Whereas when I went back in 72, we had perfect weather. It was Mike Thompson, Mike Bell, Chris Edwards. And we worked and worked and worked. 24 hours sunlight. So we were working sort of 20 plus hours a day. Then we started praying for bad weather because we, you know, it was just too good. But that first year, no, we didn't get that many good days to work. Enough to get data to take home, but quite not particularly satisfactory in terms of geology.
Did you swap partners as well at some point? You went to help George on the peninsula, didn't you? And then there was some sort of accident, I believe.
George went home. And I went up and joined Graham Smith on the peninsula. And things were going very well because on the peninsula the snow was in good condition. There was no melt up there. One day we'd been climbing and we came down and found a wind scoop. And being young idiots, good fids, we decided we'd arse-aid down the wind scoop.
I beg your pardon?
Sit on your backside and sort of sledge down like snow and you just sit down and slide. And a windscoop is, it's like a helter-skelter. So it's got a big curve in it. And it was such good fun the first time that we went back for another. And I went a bit too fast and went over the edge and landed head first on the moraine and was knocked out. And Graham came down and found me, dragged me onto the sledge, took me back to the tent, did a bit of first aid, called base, and the next day they decided to evacuate me out, which they did.
By air?
By air, yeah. And then when we went back to get Graham and the Fossil Bluff guys, that was when the Pilatus Porter was lost, because they hit Sastrugi, broke the ski. He took the ski off and tried to take off just the pilot on his own, on wheels, and he managed to turn the plane over and bent it a bit. Bent it so much it was never used again. And that's how they ended up wintering at the Bluff. Fortunately, I'd intended to winter myself, so they'd stocked the place up for me to winter. But they ended up with five guys instead of, there's only four bunks at the Bluff. So they had some privations. And that was partly why the next year we tried to sledge in early to, they wanted them relieved, just in case there was problems. And then Cape Jeremy came up.
What happened to your injuries?
Oh, a bit of concussion, gashed head. You know, I seem to fall on my head quite regularly. Basically, I could have stayed in the field if London hadn't sort of suggested that I should be. They wanted me out and passed on the boat, but I was okay.
So you only got as far as Stonington?
Yep.
By plane?
Yep.
And then there was a recovery of sorts?
There was a doctor there and he had a look at me and decided the brain wasn't all that much use anyhow.
Well, the second year, when you went back to Postlebirth, that was the year that became known as the Cape Jeremy affair. And I wonder whether you'd be kind enough to talk me through it.
Right. Although we intended to get off early, the sea ice hadn't been good in forming. It had formed and gone out and formed and gone out. So the previous year I'm looking at my book here, we'd actually set off end of August, beginning of September. The second year, we didn't get away until mid to late September. The conditions were reasonable to start, and then the weather started deteriorating, and we ran into deep soft and so forth. But the worst thing was that we got down towards Puffballs Cape Jeremy when the sea ice broke up and started drifting towards Australia. And basically we tried for several days to get off, but by that time we'd been out and been on half rations for probably a week to 2 weeks by that stage. And there was just water. So we camped. It was four of us again, but only three dog teams this time. Ali MacArthur, who was the base leader, Flavel Smith, who was the geophysicist, and Sean Norman, who was also a GA. So we had two sort of experienced climbers and so forth. Ali had done the trip the previous year, so he knew where we were going, and myself. We'd read the reports from the horseshoe event when they lost the guys.
Yeah, in the mid-50s. Some
of the dogs got home, but they didn't have harnesses on. So we worked out that when you're in that sort of situation and you're not going to get out, and that's what we decided we probably wouldn't, one night we released the dogs. And the next morning, woke up outside, and there were the dogs sitting around the tent, looking inwards. So they'd obviously tried, and they couldn't get off.
I'm not quite clear what happened. The dogs, you'd cut the dogs' traces, had you?
We released them. No, we literally took them off, took their harnesses off, and released them. And said,
they didn't go.
Go home. If you can, go. And it was too much water. They couldn't get off the floe we were on. And our floe was getting smaller because there was this iceberg that kept hitting us and breaking bits off. So we started off sort of a football pitch sort of size, and slowly it got less and less. One morning, we Flavel and I were in one tent. We decided that we'd have a good breakfast for our last day if it came to that, and we saved a few biscuits and some jam in our food box. And we woke up one morning, and there was 6 inches of water in the tent, and the jam and the biscuits were no longer edible. 24 hours later, complete change. The temperature went down like zero. There was a film of sea ice formed, and we skated across that as if we were jet-propelled. And the Stonington party had come south, and we met them about 40 miles north of where we were, and went home. And that was it.
Well, it wasn't quite it, because it was a bit hairier than I think you're indicating. Let's just go back a little bit and talk about the first indications you had that there was a problem. What were the telltale signs that the sea ice was not behaving itself as you thought it would do?
Well, it was the temperatures went up. Previous years, and again, I'm looking at my old book here, we were experiencing temperatures minus 15 to minus 20. This year, they're around the zero mark, and that's not good for sledging. It's too soft. You're sinking into the stuff and just not pleasant. Yeah,
so
you were getting wet.
You were already penetrating the surface of the ice, were you, as you went along?
The snow, yeah, the snow on top of the sea ice was soggy and not very difficult to travel with. The dogs weren't enjoying it, and we weren't enjoying it. And we were using extra paraffin to dry out in the evenings, which we shouldn't have been doing, because we only set off with 30 days food and paraffin, and although we could pick up some, you don't have a great deal of spare capacity. Yeah. You obviously, somebody's told you something which I've forgotten about.
No. I read the account in the book in Fuchs's Mice and Men. But so I'm just trying to get the process as you saw it with your own eyes. So you began to realise the ice was not behaving properly, and it was...
We started getting into broken area, but we continued south because we could make our way between them. One night... there was one night we were travelling and we spotted a seal. So we set up camp, and I'm trying to remember who went off. It wasn't me, because I was left in camp. I think it was Flavor and I were left at the tents, and Ali and Sean went off to kill the seal. And then it manked in, and weather went bad on us. And I was out with a torch, and so flashing a torch, trying to, because there's no use sort of going anywhere. I think we probably put a rope on me, and I went as far as I could to try and guide the guys back. Fortunately, they made it. But probably the dogs could smell us, and they came to us rather than any of the humans having enough ability to navigate themselves back. That night, the pressure ice hit us, and from flat ice behind us one that night, we ended up with a 14-foot pressure ridge, and I think we might have had to move tent quite rapidly because of it. But we were also getting leads, and I've got a photograph at home where it's a lead, probably 14, 15 foot, but it's just slush, snow on water. And we spent most of the day in ski across that sort of stuff, if you're quick. The dogs will run across it and might get a bit wet. And if the sledge is pulled across, one box at a time sort of thing. So we've got one guy across with a rope, attached the rope to the sledge, one box across, sledge back, second box across, and you just ferry the stuff back and forward onto the next floe. And we proceeded like that for a while. Because I didn't have a dog team, my task to a large extent was to go out and try and find a route. Sometimes we got further, sometimes we didn't make very much progress.
And all the time, this football pitch-sized piece of ice that you were on, was that floating further out to sea?
We went onto that bit at that stage. We were still making sort of 2 or 3 miles
a day.
But we're crossing cracks and new pressure ice and different cracks. It was only after then that we came to a big lead, stopped at that, then turned back to retrace our steps, but the lead behind us had opened up, so instead of a 14-foot passable stretch, there was open water again. And then we found ourselves on that football pitch.
Did you think you were a goner?
Oh yes, eventually, yeah.
Did it occur to you that you might have a stroke of luck?
Well, you know, it's hope, but you know, we were pretty pragmatic about it. Well, that's why we let the dogs off.
Yeah, and you'd obviously heard the story of the previous decade.
We'd read, as you're supposed to do, you read the sledge reports and you identify the risks. I mean, if we'd followed the rule book, even in those days there was a rule book, you're supposed to camp on an island every night. Well, if you ever had the opportunity to do that trip, it was impossible to do that, but the rule book said you had to, so we were breaking the rules. But to work in the Antarctic in those days, you could never work and keep the rule book. The rule book was there because even in those days, the survey realised that it didn't want to be liable for what idiots like the geologists did to do the work. So we had no gripes about it. We knew what we were doing.
Right.
And we went out and did it. And the risks were there. We knew what the risks were. We were young, foolhardy, and we were enjoying ourselves.
What about the first communication with anybody that you were in trouble? Did you had a radio with you?
We had a radio. We kept up regular skeds with base because, obviously, with our job being to set up... to get into the bluff to relieve the guys, we needed to know how things were and so forth, and whether the aircraft was going to turn up, because those days you never knew when the aircraft would turn up.
Mm.
But our idea was to get in there before the aircraft and just cheer them up a bit. So every night we'd have a radio sked, and most nights we could get through. Radio communications in those days were a bit hitty-missy. I don't know if they've sort of said to you that the rule was that if you're out of communication for a month, they'd inform London. And if it was 2 months, they'd get worried.
But you talked to London, didn't you?
Not direct.
No.
We sent messages to London.
Via Stanley?
No. Well, we would send a message to Stonington. Stonington relayed to Stanley. Stanley to London, and then reverse back.
Were you getting anything useful from HQ?
Simply no.
Right.
I'm very honest with you. If you read the telexes, I think one stage Fuchs suggested that one of our questions to him was, because we were drifting, and at that stage they'd just got these new satellite photographs and those satellites up there, and we thought, perhaps naively, that Fuchs could get in touch with a friend in America who would have a look at the satellite and be able to see where we were going. So we asked him, what's happening? And Fuchs' answer was that if we climbed onto Cape Jeremy, we were able to see what was happening. So you can imagine what our comments about that were. And also we got one which we shouldn't have got, which was Fuchs's message to Stonington that there was to be no rescue.
Which, you got that?
Oh, we got it. We shouldn't have got it. But it was, you know, I think it came over in Morse and we heard it. And, which was logic, because the guys at base had no better equipment than us. The boat wasn't sort of thing you want to go to sea in. It was purely the right instruction, because those guys would have risked their lives just to have a go to get us out. Fuchs was right. There's no... I think we went... There's no aircraft in the area, there's no ships in the area, and you're forbidden to attempt a rescue.
The last time...
Couldn't complain about that.
No, the last time it happened in the 50s, of course, that instruction was ignored by base commanders. Peter Gibbs and Paisley did do a search.
Yeah. And our guys set off as well. But the instructions were right.
Mm.
And we were very pleased when we met them.
I bet you were.
Because they had food.
So... what was the psychology like on board this ice, this diminishing iceberg and this ice floe? Were you?
It was quite good because we'd accepted our fate to some extent, but we weren't giving up. I mean, the day we got off, we shouldn't have gone on the ice we went on to, but we thought there was a chance, and we thought, well, let's take the chance, and if we didn't make it, we didn't make it.
Mm.
But it wasn't going to be any worse than where we were. We probably only had a couple of days left on that floe anyhow. Basically the guys were good.
So there was no infighting?
No, not fighting. the tents were separate. Flavel and I in one tent, and Ali and Sean in the other. So they were separate in that, because we were separate geographically. We camped together and we put our tent up and we did our cooking, that sort of thing, and they did their thing. So there was occasionally sort of queries whether the other tent was using more paraffin than it should for drying clothes and that sort of thing. But that just normal sledging sort of. But no, we got on very well, and we still do.
Did you consult your maker?
I did. I'm not a strong churchgoer, but I do have a faith, and yeah, I did.
So when the wind veered round and started blowing you back to land again, was that a...
I thought he made a big mistake.
When were you... Tell me about that period of time when you began to realise that maybe the wind had turned around and you were going to be okay.
That was a very short period, literally overnight, within sort of 124 hours when it looked pretty well towards the end, and the next morning, suddenly there was that freeze up, and one night's freezing sea ice doesn't give you much ice, but it was ice, which was more than we'd had before, and we just ran, literally.
So you took a risk even then?
Oh, big risk, yes, but we wanted, you know, we wanted the chance, and that was our chance, we took it.
Was that a majority decision or an unanimous verdict?
We didn't even discuss it.
Right.
We just all sort of knew what we had to do. Get the dogs, harness them, put everything on the sledge, get the tent down and go.
Did you tell Stonington you were doing that?
No. No. I don't think we had a scared at that time. Because the previous night we probably didn't know we were going to do it. So we just ran and we knew where they were and we just headed in that direction. And I don't think we stopped until we got to them.
How was that feeling when you...
Great pleasure.
Was there a party?
There was definitely a party. There was no alcohol, but there was a party. We were hungry.
I bet you were, yes.
Yeah. And they had food. So, yeah. No, there was it was a good feeling.
Did it cloud your view of your Antarctic experiences that you being so close to not coming back? Or?
No. I look with great fondness to my Antarctic time.
Okay. You had some other hairy moments as well, didn't you? One in particular on Signy Island.
Oh, well, yes. We all should learn about crevasse rescue, said our mentors on the way south. And when we got to Sydney, Malcolm, who was the first officer, decided that he would take us onto the island and give us a bit of practice. And it was all set up properly, safety harnesses, ice axes with ropes and everything, and some of the guys went to the edge, jumped over and came out no problem. My turn came and I went to the edge and they said jump, so I jumped and I fell, but I was relaxed. That was the main thing, I was relaxed. And I ended up on a snow bridge, and I was so lucky that if I'd gone a yard that side or a yard that side, I just kept on falling, and fortunately I was within rope length of a new rope, but hit this bridge.
What happened to your ropes?
They came down and joined me. That's how I found out that something had gone wrong, because this rope sort of all collapsed onto me. And apparently, and I only say this because somebody else tells me, that my reaction was to shout up, "Send a camera down," which I don't think they did. And they sent a rope down eventually, and it took a while, but I got out, and we went home, went back to the ship. There was no more practice from that day on.
So that was another lucky escape, was it?
Very lucky, yeah. And I could have just gone. I couldn't see the bottom.
There was an incident on the Northeast Glacier, with you and Sean Norman when, again, the ropes didn't do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, there was I just got back and been decided that I could stay on base, and Sean had come in as a new GA. In the autumn, we do a lot of depot laying for the next season, and also the new people learn how to run their dogs. And Sean was given a dog team. He needed to learn how to run his dogs. And he was a professional climber, and he wanted to climb mountains. So he suggested that it would be a good idea for him to practice with his dogs, do a little depot laying for the people going up Soderbred, and at the same time, we do a slight diversion on the way back and climb a peak. And off we went, and had a good day, except on the way up, I caused Sean's wrath because I spotted an avalanche somewhere off to our right and moved further to the left so I could take a photograph of Sean and the avalanche. And Sean, sort of as a professional mountaineer, suggested that if I wanted to play silly, whatever it was, that at that time of day was avalanche time and we had to get off where we were onto rock. Anyhow, we went up, got to the top, and the weather changed a bit and started, the wind came up. And somehow Sean lost his gloves, which was bad for Sean. I had mine, but you only have one pair of gloves. But again, being the professional, he said, no problem, you get me down all right. And that was almost the good thing about me in Antarctica. I'm not a good climber, but if I'm with a professional, I'll go anywhere, because they drag me up and they bring me down. Anyway, coming down, there was a big ice wall, and Sean decided to belay me up, down it, because to get any other way was going to be a big detour. And so I goes over the edge, going down using crampons and ice axes to come climb down. And I must have got about halfway when the wall itself peeled off, and I went with it, and I fell, but unfortunately the belay and probably Shorten's frozen fingers resulted in him falling as well. Now, we were up probably about 5,000 feet at this point, and we ended up down at the glacier level eventually. And we just fell and bounced and rolled and bounced and fell, and apart from a few bruises, it was the quickest way down the mountain I've ever found.
This is on snow, you were?
No, we went over rock.
Oh, really?
We looked back, and we could see the gully we'd started in, and we ended up in a different gully. So somewhere along the line, we crossed over between gullies. We were very lucky.
So was this almighty that you'd had us were with previously, or was he looking after you?
I can only think so. I mean, I've never had any personal communications, but...
Okay.
I think fools survive. It's the clever people who...
You, on the way down, as a new FID, you went to the traditional party at Government House on Stanley.
Yes.
And your etiquette was lacking at one point, slightly.
I'm afraid so. As a young man, I was teetotal, but college life and then early time on the boat, I got a taste for whiskey for some reason. But I've been told that Lady Haskarth had a limited budget, and in order to not waste it on the fids, things were watered. So I thought, well, I'll be fair, I won't have a lot, I'll just have one drink. So I got a hold of the butler and I said, look, give me one straight whiskey and I won't ask for another one. And off he trotted. But by that time I was in conversation with Lady Haskarth and a couple of other guys, and the butler returned and in a loud voice told me, here's your whiskey, sir, and there's no water in it. But she took it in very good manner. She didn't even blink. And she was very good to the fids.
Was she a kind of mother figure?
Yeah, yeah. She had You've seen Government House.
I've seen photographs, yeah.
They've got gardens and things, and she grew vegetables. And every year she put a sack of cabbages and cauliflowers and whatever she was growing, and each base got their delivery from her. So she was different.
Different?
Oh, very strong upper-class accent.
Mm.
And obviously, I think you would call it upper draw, parentage and so forth, whereas we lads were a bit sort of, as a certain minister would refer to us.
Oh, a government minister?
Yes.
Of recent
times.
This is a four-letter word beginning with P?
Yes.
Right, okay. Right. We have to explain, because this might be listened to in 50 years' time, that a government minister allegedly called the policeman a pleb and had to resign as chief whip of the Conservative Party. He went back to the Antarctic as part of this Marguerite Bay 2000 trip.
Yes.
So what were your impressions about how things had changed?
Vastly. We were the sort of the end of Fuchs's era, which wasn't expedition type work, but it was similar to it. A lot of our time was survival, as from here and what I've been talking about was survival. What I saw was modern science carried out in the Antarctic scenery. The people were very dedicated, very capable. They had very strict timetables and programs to follow. The only thing I thought was wrong with it was I don't think they lifted their heads and looked at the horizon.
How do you mean?
I don't think they appreciated where they were. You know, it was as if they were still working in Cambridge, Birmingham, wherever, and they just happened to be in a bit of snow and ice, and they did the work, and they didn't winter to a large extent in those days, the scientists, that is. I think you have to winter, really, to appreciate the Antarctic.
Are you suggesting the wonders passed them by?
Perhaps not. It's just my impression of them. They perhaps did appreciate it, but they didn't seem to. To some extent, the new life in our days, as a geologist, I was the lowest of the low, in as much I had no other skills, whereas the radio operator was essential for communication, the diesel mechanic. The diesels didn't work, you didn't have any electricity. The GAs were the climbers and the skiers, and they looked after us geologists. I was allowed to assist the diesel mechanic to decoke his engine. I could pass him his spanner. Chris Madders allowed me to learn sufficient Morse so that he could have a holiday, so I could take over the radio operator's duties for a couple of weeks. Nowadays, the scientists have their own suite, ensuite facilities. Somebody makes their bed for them. Somebody washes their clothes for them. And perhaps I'm exaggerating, but there's a kitchen staff.
Mm.
And I was talking to the kitchen people on that trip.
At Rothera.
Mm. And I got the impression that the scientists didn't mix very much with other personnel. And I saw this when we came down and stopped off at Anvers back in the 70s. And that second trip I went down, height of the Vietnam War. So you had the scientists and you had military. And the choice for the military people had been Vietnam or the Antarctic. And most of those guys wished they'd chosen at Vietnam. We got there and there was all these cardboard boxes on the jetty. And it was snowing and it was raining. And being FIDs, we thought, well, what's going on here? And the scientists met us and said, oh, just leave it there. The soldiers will clear the jetty when they come out of the cinema, because it was the afternoon cinema for them, the guys. But being FIDs, we said, no way, that stuff's going to be ruined if it's left there. So we formed a human chain and we got all the boxes and took them up to the base. Just as the time the soldiers' film finished and they came out, And suddenly the soldiers were our friends because we'd done what they would have had to have done. We were part of them. And a good base is not a, should not be divided like that. There shouldn't be staff and scientists. That's not good for morale. It immediately split. If you ever went to an Argentinian base in those days, there was two or three officers who lived in 90% of the base, and the rest of the peons, plebs in British terms, were there as servants.
Mm.
That's not good. And our base, when it came 13 on base, every 13th day you were on cook. Then you had your gash hand, which was washing the dishes, taking the toilet buckets to the tide crack. Another day you were feeding the dogs. You did everything, as well as being a scientist. And that was what Antarctica was all about. Everybody worked together, and you became a very close and united group. And I think I understand why they don't do it now, because you don't get the time to do all the science that they try and pack in. But that's how we are so much more together as a unit than I think the modern ones. You know, they come back, they go back to the university, and they move on.
Do you think the FIDs, who you met at Rothera in the 21st century, did they have a particular view about their predecessors, including you?
Well, I was very surprised because I met the then deputy director, who I didn't know from Adam. But apparently he'd been a new FID the year after Cape Jeremy. And apparently he'd shaken my hand on the way out. And as far as he was concerned, I was a folk hero.
You were in the mythology.
I was in the mythology. Well, I suppose with Cape Jeremy, you had to be in the mythology. Yeah. But you know, it only struck me then how these... And he wasn't a young guy. He was probably late 40s, early 50s. But he looked upon us as a different breed. And he's a deputy director. So he wasn't sort of just a new FID.
So when the boat arrived at Rothera with 30 or 40 veteran FIDs on board, they were treated with a certain respect by them?
Oh, very much, yes. They were very, very friendly to us. And there was a couple of... There was the guy who was a dealer mechanic at Adelaide in that period, and he was the senior engineer in Cambridge, who was on a trip, so we knew him. So we knew a couple of people, and they'd obviously been talking to people on base. They were very friendly people. They showed us around, and we marvelled at the amount of equipment, the amount of aircraft they had, and they hadn't lost one for a long time. I think we had a bit of a Jonah on all the aircraft.
Let's just go back, if we may, Lawrence, to the your decision to go back to the Antarctic. You did your couple of years at Stonington, then at 72 you went back south again. Mm. I think you offered a proper job, weren't you?
I was offered a full-time post, yes.
Did you leap at that?
Oh, yes. I fully intended to stay with the Antarctic Survey the rest of my career if I could.
So what happened?
Folks had retired. And on his final visit to Birmingham, he'd taken me aside and suggested that I should perhaps look for a different career because things were going to change. And at that stage, I thought, no, you know, things will just carry on as they are. You know, there'll be changes. It's a new guy at the top. But what was happening, which I didn't realise, was the move to get rid of the dogs was already being mooted at higher places. Now, anybody who's sledged with dogs, you can't explain, I don't think, to anybody else how you feel about your dogs and everybody else's dogs. They're just, they're your children. And when we went back the second time, there was four geologists and we used skidoos. What we didn't realise was that we were the... been used as a test case to prove to others that dogs weren't necessarily required. Skidoos had been in the Antarctic prior to that. We actually had one on base. But but they were mechanically very unreliable. Basically, they weren't good. We, as I said earlier, we had an excellent summer. We had 100 days on the ice, and we worked 100 days. And we were more productive in that period than most people have been for yonks. But to come back and find that because we'd been successful, this was being used against the dogs. Every night, we'd strip those engines down, we'd fiddled with them, we'd looked after them. We'd been very lucky, we'd gone over crevasses, which we shouldn't have gone over, but we had some experience to some extent where the crevasses were going to be. So it was four experienced guys.
Mm.
And to find that this was being used against the dogs was a bit of a... not a good one. But once I became permanent, they allocated you to different committees, and I was allocated to the safety and field committee. And another thing which, because I'd by then become a... what do you call them? Associate Fellow of Birmingham University, which was one way of getting a car parking place. But part of the deal was that you would befriend the students. And every year there was the annual sort of job market. And that first year, the shell guy came and the students had asked me to go in with them because they were a bit shy. I don't know, things have changed a lot about shyness of students, but they felt a bit shy. And I'd asked a few inane questions to the shell guy just to keep the things running. And at the end, they hand out application forms. And this guy came over to me and said, "You obviously interested in your questions, but you haven't filled in an application form." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not really. I'm quite happy with the job I've got." Then we did the trip, came back, and again, the next year, there's a lot of students, and I was in on that. And the shell guy came over and said, "Look, go to The Hague for a week. All expenses paid. Enjoy yourself, talk to the guys over there. No sort of ties. If you don't want it, don't. But go have a week's holiday." So I rang up London and I said to the secretary, "Look, I really need to get this committee a meeting and discuss what's happening because I've got certain qualms about what's been said and done. Reference the dogs and the skidoos." And the secretary said, "Sorry, the director's far too busy to have a committee meeting." So I said, "Fair enough. Do you think I could have a week's leave?" "Yeah, no problem, week's leave. C-Ray 80, week's leave. Yes, no problem." Go to The Hague. I had a good week, met some nice guys. They offered me a job. I didn't take it at that stage. I went back to Birmingham, rang up London and said, "Look, I really want that committee to sit and discuss things. It's 2 years since that committee met. It's far too long. There's things happening. You put me on the committee. I'm asking the director, seriously, we must have that meeting." And she said, "Basically, you're not going to have that meeting. He's not going to have it. There's things happening. He doesn't want to talk to you." So I said, "Okay. My resignation's in the post."
This was Dick Laws, I presume.
Yep.
Yeah. And were you... Sorry.
Dick was probably right. I'm not saying... I think I was wrong.
Well, were you not railing against progress?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That's what I say. I think Dick was right. But as I said to you, the emotions about dogs and reality are two different things. I was quite mild compared to some of the guys' reaction to... what was going on. But I couldn't stand and watch the changes. I wanted to stay, but I wouldn't stay if I wasn't at least able to go to a committee meeting and talk to the guy.
You were being denied access to the director, weren't you?
He might have come in and told me what was reality, and you know, and I might have accepted it. I don't know. I was denied that possibility. And that's...
Are you still bitter about that?
No, no, I think Dick
Because your career looks quite promising afterwards.
Dick was doing the right thing for the survey.
Yeah.
You know, I say, I was living in Fuchs's, and Fuchs had told me I couldn't continue living... You know, we had a whale of a lifetime, but things had to change. No, no, I was the one in the wrong. I let my emotions rule my head.
Yeah.
But I was, as far as I was concerned, I had responsibilities for the guys, and I thought their lives were put at risk by going into skidoos at that time without really thinking it through. And dogs lasted for a few more years.
So you're concerned that the introduction of skidoos was a bit rapid, were you?
Yeah. For people, I was thinking in terms of myself going down as a greenhorn and be put in the field with skidoos. There was no one in Britain who had experience of working skidoos. So whereas we had old GAs who knew about dogs.
Are you speaking here with your health and safety hat on?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to send people into the field with skidoos into crevasses. You couldn't take the skidoos over sea ice. So you're going to have to go on the... I'll rely on aircraft, but going to crevassed areas and no dogs. Dogs have a sixth sense. They can pick out crevasses that you don't see. We had one occasion on the sea ice in the Manc on that first trip. George's team were going and suddenly stopped. And George, a bit short-tempered, and I was behind him. So eventually George said, go and sort that. There was a female leader, go and sort that bitch out. So I wanders up to the bitch, and she's sitting down, and I get to her. And then I suddenly realise she stopped at a deep chasm. And what we'd done, we'd sledged up a Tablier Berg, up to the top of it, and as a good dog should, she didn't want to go over the top and fall. Yeah, they've just got dog sense.
So were your fears ever borne out? Were there some early skidoo accidents down to lack of experience?
I don't think anybody was killed.
Yeah.
No. So I don't think I was. But I say the dogs did continue for a while. So it was. Things weren't happening as I thought they might.
Fair enough.
But my worries were there, and the fact that I couldn't talk to anybody was sort of made it worse.
A mark of disrespect.
Shouldn't put people on committees if you don't have committee meetings. You know?
I mentioned your illustrious career right around the world more than once, it seems to me, but you enigmatically refer to an underground accident that brought your career to a conclusion in 1992, yet you are still here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was lucky.
Again?
Yes, yeah. I was working in...
Let's finish with this. What happened to you?
I was a consultant by that stage, and I was sent by the British government to assist the Iranian government during one of the lulls in diplomatic crossfire. And I was working, I went underground with some of their party, and there was a fall, and I went down with it and was buried.
Pothole, is it?
No, no, and a mine.
In a mine?
Mine fall. And afterwards, the Iranians sort of chatting, and they said, well, basically, they decided to dig me out because if I died, then the mine would have been haunted by this Christian, which wasn't looked upon as a good thing. So they got me out. But I had a bit head injury, which was a bit more than, well, it could be sort of adding on to previous injuries and so forth. And I lost my sight for a while. And basically the insurance for the company wasn't on.
You were uninsurable.
Well, yeah. So they offered me early retirement. I did one last trip to Spitsbergen, so I thought, you know, I've gone south and I've gone north, and they offered me early retirement, I'll take it. And I did. End of career.
The beginning of being a Justice of the Peace.
I did a couple of other voluntary things before that. Coming up 14 years, coming 15 years, which I've enjoyed. Mm.
Despite the rather sour ending when you weren't being listened to in 74, how does the Antarctic years rate in your life?
Oh, very high. Yes. So, boys wonder. So, boys with toys. And I say we were very fortunate. I think we were the lucky generation. Mm. So, throughout, so in generality, people of our age, we didn't have to go and fight a war. We had possibilities of education which weren't available to other people. We had jobs. I worked in Australia for a while, and I love to tell the Australians that when I was at college, the High Commissioner for Australia used to come round and say, right, we'll fly you to Australia, and this is the time of the £10 palm on the boat. We'll fly you to Australia, have a look around Australia, see if there's anything you like. We'll fly you home, fix up the paperwork, and we'll fly you back again to do the work. And the Australians didn't like that. But that's how life was. And we've been very lucky.
You've been very lucky on many occasions, it seems to me, Lawrence. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.